Brouwer in almost full force, right? Thanks for listening. Enjoy your Memorial Day weekend. Don't forget, Democracy Now's got the event with the veterans throwing their medals at the NATO generals on Monday.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the May 26th edition, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streamed worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of broadcasting are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bill to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information, or for the Unemployed and Underemployed Helpline, call 217-328-2295. This hour programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to contribute their support, continue their support for the Illinois Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. The Illinois Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Bill. I'm your host this week, Bob Pelesny, and I'm here with co-host and founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, one of the founders, Bill Gorell, and we'll have some workers' interest news for you here today, and also some, I think, Bill will fill in for Tom on the cultural corner and do some stuff for us there, so it'll be just the two of us here, so we'll try to keep you entertained and informed. And I can start it off, I guess, with a news story here. Actually, Bill was talking about the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way, and I came across a story here about railroad unions. So let me see if I can dig that one up there. Railroad workers convened to shake up the unions. This was, again, from our friend Mike Elk, great labor reporter, and inside notes, and okay, he starts off and says this week, Wednesday, May 23rd, up in Chicago, says last year over 92,000 railroad workers represented 11 different unions, and they agreed to a series of concessionary contracts, while the four largest railroad companies collected $8.5 billion in profits. The problem? Railroad unions are typically forced into concessions because the federal government holds the power to step in and to stop railway strikes. Therefore, individual unions often race to make their own deals, hoping that settling quickly will allow their unions to negotiate a slightly better deal with the railroads. It's a disheartening situation for union members, which is why in 2008, several railroad unionists joined to form Railroad Workers United, RWU. It's a cross-craft association of workers from over 17 different unions. And together, the RWU members plan to challenge the often top-down structure of railroad unions, which they felt hindered their ability to fight against rail companies. RWU is a small, volunteer-run organization with a budget of only a few thousand dollars and about 200 members who pay just $50 in annual dues. But despite limited means, RWU members hope that by serving as the voices of dissent in their unions, they can bring about positive changes that will ultimately lead to improved working conditions. Earlier this month, 40 members and allies of RWU gathered in Chicago for a one-day convention to discuss ways to expand our organization. Success, of course, requires planning and some bureaucracy. Topics of discussion at the convention included strategies to reach new members and to encourage them to pay dues, methods of distributing the RWU newsletter, the Highball, and for placing stickers with RWU contact information on locomotives across the country. It says here in parentheses, which RWU General Secretary Ron Kamenkow considers a highly successful tactic in recruiting new members. And many of the members here are upset with unions they see as top-heavy and out of touch with the needs of members, and they say the top-down structures that have led unions to agree to unnecessary and ultimately harmful concessions. So this convention was going on in Chicago, and you can check it out, RWU, Railroad Workers United. So.
Well, here's a brief story from the National Labor Relations Board. A federal judge has ordered a Piggly Wiggly supermarket in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, to restore full-time status and health insurance to employees whose hours were reduced to part-time without bargaining with their union, and to refrain from making such unilateral changes in the future. At the request of the National Labor Relations Board, Chief Judge C. N. Clevert Jr. of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, a lot of districts and stuff in here, also ordered the supermarket to immediately offer reinstatement to four employees who resigned after their hours were reduced. The temporary injunction will continue until the underlying case is resolved by the NLRB. According to a complaint issued by the NLRB regional office in Milwaukee, supermarket managers reduced the hours of 19 employees without notice, citing the impending opening of a non-union competitor nearby. The move to part-time status also resulted in the loss of health insurance. Supermarket employees are represented by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 1473. At the time of the reduction of hours, Piggly Wiggly managers berated union officials for not helping the employees in letters that were posted on the bulletin board. Judge Clevert noted the unilateral reductions, openly hostile to the union, and efforts to undermine the union's credibility in issuing the injunction, which restores the union's bargaining position and requires that the future changes to employee status will be negotiated with the union.
All right. I got a story here, too. This is kind of from financial pages, and it says that analysts back at Hewlett-Packard's layoff plans. Hewlett-Packard's been struggling lately, and although they are the world's number one personal computer maker, but they say analysts say Hewlett-Packard's company's plan to cut jobs was a step in the right direction, but the PC maker will have to do more to regain investors' confidence. So HP announced this week layoffs of 27,000 workers, or 8% of its workforce, which would be mainly through early retirement and would generate annual savings, they say, of $3 billion to $3.5 billion a year. Company employs about 300,000 globally, and they seem to say that laying off employees is the best way for them to get their house in order, although they've had a series of missteps and printing issues and PC making. They pulled a tablet off the market a while back, and now they're going to go back in and seemingly start making a tablet again. But it seems to me that they're trying to blame it on the workers, laying off 27,000 workers. They seem to think they can save $3.5 billion a year. If that's accurate, 27,000 people must have all been making about $130,000 a year from that company, which is pretty nice. Pretty nice pay from HP. Anyway, stock market analysts seem to think that's the way that, because the stock went up 6% the other day. So,
Like layoffs.
Yeah, yeah. That makes the company much more profitable.
Well, anyway, Reuters reports that a top German union official will explain to hourly employees at Volkswagen's U.S. plant in early June that his group will not pressure them to join the United Auto Workers Union, the automaker's top labor representative said on Thursday. The UAW is relying heavily on the IG Metall, which has members on Volkswagen's Works Council, to help it organize German-owned U.S. plants because the German union has influence with Volkswagen management. While the Volkswagen Works Council supports the United Auto Workers' efforts to organize workers at the company's plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, it will not use its influence to help the U.S. Union, Works Council Chief Bernd Osterloh said at Volkswagen's headquarters here. And here is Wolfsburg, Germany. The Works Council is the labor counterpart to company management, consisting of representatives from all the factories and brands in the Volkswagen Group. Osterloh told reporters, quote, "Of course, we will support the UAW. We've said that all along. But there's one thing we cannot do. We cannot take workers at Volkswagen Chattanooga by the hand when it comes to voting on UAW representation. One has to be in favor if one wants union representation." Osterloh said, Works Council General Secretary Frank Patta will outline the labor group's position to the Tennessee factory workers in early June. United Auto Workers officials declined to discuss Osterloh's comments. UAW President Bob King has said repeatedly that the future success of his union depends on organizing the U.S. plants of foreign automakers, including Daimler's Mercedes and Japan's Nissan Motor Company. However, many of those plants are located in the South, where anti-union feelings are stronger and union membership levels are lower. Gee, do you think that's a coincidence?
No. No coincidence whatsoever, Bill.
VW executives have said repeatedly it was up to the workers of the plant whether the UAW represents them, a stance plant spokesman Gunther Scherlis reiterated on Thursday. Volkswagen builds the Passat sedan in Tennessee. In March, sources said the United Auto Workers solicited signature of support from workers at Volkswagen's Tennessee plant in an early formal step needed for union representation. However, at meetings with plant employees, comments by some workers that the UAW was not needed in the factory were met with loud applause. Osterloh said the Works Council would support the formation of some type of lobbying group to represent the Tennessee workers if they rejected the UAW, but did not explain what format that would take. Osterloh said, quote, "Should workers determine they don't want a union, we would make efforts to bring about some sort of interest lobby. It's important that this site has a voice on the Global Works Council." Osterloh said it was up to the UAW and not the Works Council to convince the U.S. hourly employees. "Sentiment in the southern U.S. isn't exactly in favor of unions," he said. "We'll make sure that the UAW has a real chance. If the workforce doesn't want this, though, then we have a problem." After 3 decades of declining membership, the UAW faces a financial crunch that has been exacerbated by the U.S. economic downturn. This has forced America's richest union to sell assets and dip into its strike fund to pay for activities. Well, I mean, you know, I got to say that I'm going to have to possibly agree with IG Metall on this. If anything, we have to be democratic about stuff.
Yeah.
You know, for one thing, there will be a dues paying and such. So, yeah, it's just too bad. It's just too bad that the sentiment is like that.
Yeah.
Because they could probably get him to do a card check.
Yeah.
You know, at least.
Yeah. I got a story here again out of Quebec, and we talked recently a few times about mining companies and stuff, and this is referring to Rio Tinto again. Quebec steelworkers face a mining pariah, it says. In a town of 30,000 people, when 8,000 demonstrate, it does not go unnoticed. In the small community of Alma in southern Quebec, unions gathered on March 31st for a solidarity march to denounce the lockout of 780 aluminum workers. They came from all over Quebec and Canada and from a dozen countries where the multinational mining giant Rio Tinto has installations. In a Quebec where everything is in motion, where a student uprising of thousands is manifesting each day in the streets of Montreal, this fight is resonating. Representatives from Rio Tinto unions worldwide and the ICEM, the Global Federation of Mining and Energy Unions, met to strategize against the aggressively anti-worker company. Rio Tinto has become a target of activists worldwide for its mistreatment of workers and its pillage of the environment as it strips aluminum, gold, iron ore, copper, uranium, coal, and diamonds out of the earth. In 2010, it locked California boron miners out of their jobs for 107 days seeking concessions. On April 16th, the Union Federations launched the Off the Podium campaign. You can check that out on the web at offthepodium.org, asking the International Olympic Committee to exclude Rio Tinto from the list of official suppliers for the London Olympics. Metals used to make the Olympic medals come from Rio Tinto mines. The aluminum smelter works of Rio Tinto Alcan argue that it goes against Olympic values of solidarity and fair play for an employer to put his workers out of the factory door on a cold New Year's Eve in the middle of the night without any warning. Workers were not even allowed to go through the normal decontamination process to wash off the toxic beryllium they work with, as 150 security guards from outside the province escorted them through the gates. Management was demanding that Steelworkers Local 9490 agreed to replace workers who retire with subcontracted workers paid half their salary without benefits or a pension. The Alma facility is the most profitable aluminum smelter in Quebec. So, another in the series of big corporations taking advantage of their workers, reaping in huge profits, but refusing to pay their workers. So, anyway, got another story or so there, Bill, or I got something queued up here from Hightower Radio.
I want to hear Jim Hightower.
Yeah, he talks about the 10 worst jobs, so let's check this out here.
I've concluded that there are two kinds of people in our world, those willing to believe there are only two kinds of people, and those who think it's a bit more complex than that. Speaking of questionable enumerations, the list of the 10 worst jobs of 2012 is out, and I seem to have two of them. Both newspaper reporter and broadcaster made the list. Okay, I'm not technically a reporter, I'm a columnist, but let's not be picky. These used to be considered quasi-glamorous gigs, but CareerCast, the online compiler of the list, says that the decline in job opportunities and pay in the media world, plus the rise in on-the-job stress, have pushed these down to the 5th and 10th worst career choices out there. It's true that the pay is lower middle class, but there's no heavy lifting, and hey, us commentator types essentially get paid just for running our mouths. Pretty good work if you can get it. Top of the worst list is lumberjack. I can see that. Yes, being outdoors is a plus if the weather's good. But screaming chainsaws and huge trees crashing down would put you on edge every day, and maybe in your grave. Dairy farmers rank number 2. It's a noble profession in my view, but most people don't realize that these hard-working and skilled yeomen literally are married to their cows. The lady bovines have to be milked twice a day, including weekends and holidays, no matter the weather or whether you're sick or tired. Other bottom tenners are oil rig workers. Can you say BP? Dishwashers. They get no respect and sorry pay. Butchers. Missing fingers are a routine job hazard there. And waiting tables. Lousy pay and constant abuse from managers and customers alike. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, millions of Americans today can tell you that by far the worst job is looking for one.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
And thanks, as always, to Jim Hightower for his insight into the world out there. I was cruising through Springfield last weekend on the way to St. Louis and stopped by Mount Olive, Illinois, and they have the Union Miners Cemetery there, which is famous for being the final resting place of Mary Mother Jones, the world's most dangerous woman. So I'm going to play this track from Utah Phillips and Annie DeFranco about Mary Mother Jones and the Miners Memorial down there in Mount Olive Cemetery. Quite touching to see that she wanted to be buried with what she considered her boys, the many guys that had died in the Verdun coal strike and whatnot years before that. So anyway, here's Utah Phillips and Annie DeFranco.
Traveling through Illinois when I was invited to stop and sing at a memorial there in the little town of Mount Olive. Now, who of note in American history is buried in the cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois? I'll give you a hint. It was a woman. It was the Union Miners Cemetery. Do you have it yet? Mary Harris. Mary Harris Jones. Mother Jones. It's hard for the mind to encompass a life that embraced the presidencies between Andrew Jackson and Herbert Hoover. Why, when Mother Jones was a little girl, there were people still alive who remembered the Revolutionary War. And she died on the eve of the New Deal. Her millinery shop burned down in the Chicago fire, and she had heard Abraham Lincoln speak in person. Mostly, though, Mother Jones was the miner's friend. Down in Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, well, the men would be organizing the underground workers, the miners. Mother Jones had already organized their wives and led them over the snow-covered game trails down into the Hollis, where, armed with mops and brooms, they drove the scabs out of the coal pits. Now, Mother Jones wasn't an organizer, she was an agitator, which meant often enough she was hated as much by the organizers as by the bosses. One time, Mother Jones was out in Colorado at the great Ludlow strike. Now, that was the strike to enforce the 8-hour day, which the state of Colorado had made a law, but they couldn't enforce it because Rockefeller owned the militia. Now, the governor promised not to send the militia into the coal fields, but he lied, and he did. Mother Jones was in the Union Hall down there at Ludlow, and word came that the militia had entered the coal fields. Well, she leapt up, and she screamed, "Let's go get the sons of bitches!" And she stormed out. She didn't look to see if anybody was following her. Nobody was following her. She just flounced up the road alone and confronted the militia. And that was the year that President Theodore Roosevelt called Mother Jones the most dangerous woman in America. And she was 83 years old. That's some kind of dangerous.
Annie DeFranco and Utah Phillips with their tribute to Mary Mother Jones, buried down there at the Union Miners Cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois, and the most dangerous woman in America. So, anyway, I got another news story here about the Chicago public school system and teachers, and says here the CPS teachers fill a union rally with anger toward mayor. They got stunted raises, longer hours, leave educators ready for a strike. This happened just the other day, May 24th. It says Mayor Rahm Emanuel bore the brunt of criticism from angry teachers who filled the auditorium theater on Wednesday to make clear their unhappiness with the administration's efforts to overhaul public education in Chicago. The crowd of nearly 4,000 teachers, almost all wearing red union T-shirts, erupted in shouts of fight and strike when Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis asked rhetorically, "So why are we here?" "He's lost touch with reality," Harper High School teacher John Thewitt said of Emanuel before the rally. "I feel like we're getting walked on. They're extending our hours, not giving us raises, and if we don't stop it now, I don't know when it will stop." Outside the theater, a crowd of about 1,000 teachers, parents, and members of other unions gathered in Congress Plaza chanting, "Stand up and fight back." The rally, which brought in state and national education labor leaders, was staged amid ongoing contract talks between Chicago Teachers Union and the Chicago Public Schools. The positions of both sides are being considered by a 3-member panel which will issue its findings in mid-July, one of several steps that must be taken before teachers can walk out under a state law passed last year. You're in the midst of a great fight, Illinois Federation of Teachers President Daniel Montgomery told the crowd. We may not avoid this fight that the mayor wants, American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten promised to come back every time you need me to. Speaking at a news conference earlier Wednesday, Emanuel, whose newly appointed school board cut teachers' raises as one of its first acts, said teachers deserve more money. This is Rahm Emanuel saying this. Chicago teachers deserve a pay raise, Emanuel said. They work very hard. They deserve a pay raise. Chicago school children do not deserve a strike. We are working with an independent arbiter to ensure that we achieve both of these goals, and we're committed to that process. But inside the auditorium, teachers angry about being forced to work a longer day without additional compensation booed loudly whenever Emanuel's name was mentioned. Lewis again told the story of how the mayor cussed her out when she questioned him over his proposal for a longer day last fall. According to the union, Chicago Public Schools has offered teachers a 2% pay raise next year and no salary increase in the second year. After that, a system of merit pay would be implemented. The union has asked for far different amelioration from the Chicago Public Schools there. So, anyway, we'll see what happens up there in Chicago. And I think we're going to go to a little bit of workers' independent news here. And we'll be back with some more news and commentary. So, stay tuned.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Illinois House passed a school bus safety bill strongly supported by Teamsters Joint Council 25 and Teamsters Local 777. Governor Pat Quinn is expected to sign it into law. The measure stresses safety, making it a top priority as school districts award bus service contracts. It also broadens responsible bidding overall, according to Teamsters Joint 25 spokesperson Will Petty.
We're trying to insert language into the school code that promotes safety, not something that promotes our own personal contracts. We're trying to increase safety and responsibility in this industry.
Petty says the Teamsters are working hard nationwide with their Drive Up Standards campaign in school busing.
We have found the campaign to be extremely successful and have found school bus drivers to be incredibly receptive nationwide. Just recently, the Teamsters nationally celebrated its 300th win of organizing school bus yards around the country, and that translates to about 34,000 to 35,000 workers.
As Wisconsin's June 5th recall election draws closer, grassroots activist Lori Compass hit a home run in her first debate with Republican State Senate leader Scott Fitzgerald. Compass single-handedly took Fitzgerald on, organizing a recall campaign that collected more than 20,000 signatures. Compass strongly supported collective bargaining rights in the debate, equating them with democracy on the job. When asked if she would have joined Democratic Wisconsin State Senators who went to Illinois to block a vote on the bill ending collective bargaining rights for public workers, Compass had this response.
Well, if I'd been in the Senate, we wouldn't have needed to go to Illinois.
Jesse Russell has more now on this historic effort to recall State Senator Scott Fitzgerald in Wisconsin.
State Senator Scott Fitzgerald was the Senate Majority Leader in 2011 and acted as Walker's bulldog in the Senate, keeping the party in line and pushing through legislation as fast as possible. When the Democratic Party of Wisconsin decided the odds to collect signatures to recall Fitzgerald were too high, Lori Compass disagreed and, with zero support from state Democrats, collected nearly 10,000 more signatures than required. She later on decided, at the urging of constituents in her district, to challenge Fitzgerald in the recall election. Wednesday night, Compass and Fitzgerald faced off in a debate. When asked about Act 10, which stripped most collective bargaining rights away from state workers, Fitzgerald rolled out the often-repeated fallacy that Act 10 was only about bringing public employee pay and benefits closer to parity with the private sector. Compass responded that Act 10 didn't only address pay, but it also took away an important voice for workers when it comes to safety in the workplace.
I've heard from prison guards who say that attacks are up and they don't have the right to go and negotiate their workplace safety rules anymore. It's not just about salary and benefits. I think that we can discuss cuts and concessions, but I think that everyone deserves a chance to come to the table.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And we're back, and you are listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour, and here on WEFT, Champaign 90.1 FM. And I think we're still kind of in our pledge drive. You can make your pledge right now. You can give us a call at area code 217-359-9338, or you can go to our website at weft.org. Or if you got one of our letters, you can mail it in to WEFT P.O. Box 1223, Champaign, Illinois, 61824. And public service announcement I can give you here, too. Don't forget, we can you can tune in this Sunday and every Sunday to Labor's View TV, brought to you over the air on local cable channel 6, Urbana Public Television. And it features one of our hosts here, David Johnson, and also a friend of the show, Jim Iman. It's every Sunday at 4 o'clock, Labor's View TV. And, you know, we had our had a good turnout last night at the David Gann Show over there at the Iron Post. Also had the Curses playing and whatnot. If you do pledge, $40 is our suggested basic level. If you do pledge at $40, you can become a member of WEFT, and that entitles you to take our free air shifter training course. I think we got another one of those starting up here in June, maybe the end of June. Go through a couple of classroom sessions and a couple of studio sessions here. We teach you how to push the buttons on the CD players, slide the sliders on the board here, and you too can be doing your own radio show. As David Johnson likes to mention whenever he's here talking about Pledge Drive, you're not going to hear this kind of radio, these kind of news stories and stuff on corporate radio in this area or any area, really. So do your best. We have a lot of great music programs on the station, a lot of great public affairs programs. Lori Serb has a great program on Friday mornings. Dog is my co-pilot, a nice mix of music and public affairs. The guys coming up here after this, Occupy the Airwaves, put on a great show every Saturday afternoon. Paul Muse Show on Saturdays, News from Neptune, always brings you a bunch of great great information. So I'll see if Bill's ready to go with his computer there, or if not, we're going to listen to a track from Walter Trout here. I guess we're going to listen to Walter Trout. Here you go, from his newest CD, Blues for Modern Days, DAZE.
Presented, I think I
is Walter Trout in his best rock and blues mode with the tune titled Money Rules the World from his latest CD, Blues for Modern Days. And I think Bill's ready to go over there. You got something off the computer there?
Yeah, folks. I like to avoid printing things out, and but for some reason this computer's being really contrary today. But anyway, today is the 75th anniversary. Well, maybe not today exactly, but it was actually not today. It's May 30th, tomorrow, is the 75th anniversary of the Memorial Day Massacre in Chicago. And what I have here is a piece by left journalist and novelist, for that fact, Howard Fast.
Yeah.
And this was a article, actually two articles that he wrote for The Masses.
Hmm.
And the editors say, 10 years have passed since that bloodstained date, May 30th, 1937. Many have forgotten. Millions more have joined the labor and progressive movement since that time and do not know this story. But it is well that all of us remember and in remembering act. For this is what is meant by today's headlines, by today's sessions of Congress. This is what will happen again if the Taft-Hartley anti-labor bill is enacted. This is the program of the National Association of Manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce. This is what they want to do to America, to you. They're moving fast. Are you? Well, if the editors of The Masses felt that that was the situation only 10 years after the massacre, is, of course, much more exacerbated now. I don't remember learning in school about the Memorial Day Massacre.
No, no. Nope.
And it happened in Chicago, and I went to school in Illinois.
I grew up in Chicago.
Really?
And I don't remember them teaching that school at all.
Yeah, actually, the first time I heard of this massacre was it was on a tape given to me by the Labor Vision people in St. Yeah. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And it also had some really good video of SEIU action in Century City in California. This was back in the 1990s. And it was the oppression by the cops there was brutal. It was much similar, except the police didn't shoot.
Yeah.
Unlike in Chicago in 1937. And I also think that this is, and we've seen such police violence over the last year in the various Occupy situations, except for Wisconsin, where the police were actually part of the protest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. But afterwards in Occupy Wall Street and
Oakland and
right,
Portland,
yes.
Chicago. But, the list goes on. Yeah,
especially in New York and Oakland, there's a lot of violence, definitely on the hands of the cops. And at most, a little bit of property damage by a fringe group of protesters. But anyway, Memorial Day in Chicago in 1937, it wasn't like that. There's basically, I'll set the scene a little for you. And there's a film of this.
Hmm.
There was actually a camera, film camera. It must have been inside the plant. It's behind the police.
Oh,
and you can see this happening. But anyway, I'll get back to Mr. Fast, Comrade Fast, maybe we should say. Memorial Day in Chicago in 1937 was hot, humid, and sunny. It was the right kind of day for the parade and the holiday, the kind of a day that takes the soreness out of a Civil War veteran's back and makes him feel like stepping out with the youngsters a quarter his age. It was a day for picnics, for boating, for the beach, or for a long ride into the country. And it was a day when patriotic sentiments could be washed down comfortably with Coca-Cola or a Tom Collins, as you preferred. And there's no doubt but that a good deal of that holiday feeling was present in the strikers who gathered on the prairie outside and around Republic Steel's Chicago plant. Most of the strikers felt good. Tom Girdler, who ran Republic, had said that he would go back to hoeing potatoes before he met the strikers' demands. And the word went around that old Tom could do worse and earn an honest living hoeing potatoes. The strike was less than a week old. The strikers had not yet felt the pinch of hunger, and there was a good sense of solidarity everywhere. Because it was such a fine summer day, many of the strikers brought their children out onto the prairie to attend the first big mass meeting. And wherever you looked, you saw two-year-olds and three-year-olds riding pickaback on the shoulders of steelworkers. And because it was in the way of there being their special occasion, as well as a patriotic holiday, the women wore their best and brightest. In knots and clusters, the younger folks two by two, the older people in family groups, they drifted towards Sam's Place on South Green Bay Avenue. Once, Sam's Place had been a 10-cent dance hall. Now it was a strike headquarters, which meant, in terms of the strike, just about everything. There, the women had set up their soup kitchen, and there, the union strategy board planned the day-to-day work. Food was collected at Sam's Place, and pickets used it as their barracks and headquarters. Today, several thousand people gathered around the improvised platform set up at Sam's Place to listen to the speakers and to take part in the mass demonstration. How serious an occasion it was, they knew well enough. Rumors circulated that the police were going to attempt something special, something out of the run of clubbing and gassing which had marked the strike from the very first day. Rumors, too, that a mass picket line was going to be established today. It was a serious occasion. But somehow, something in the day, the holiday, the sunshine and the warm southern weather, or excuse me, summer weather, made the festive air persist. Vendors wheeled wagons of cold pop and brick ice cream, three flavors in one, was to be had at a Nicola cake. For the young folks, it was the first strike. They sat under the trees with the girls, grinning at the way the strike committee worked and poured sweat. And the women, working inside the hall, reflected, as hundreds of generations of women had reflected before, that man's work is from sun to sun, but women's work, .. A group of girls sang, strikes were around, our strike songs were around, a new turn in the folk literature of the nation, first shyly, hesitantly, then with more vigor, with a rising volume augmented by the deep bass and rich baritone of the men. They sang the deathless tale of Joe Hill, the songmaker and organizer whom the cops had killed. They sang, solidarity forever, the union makes us strong. They sang of the nameless IWW worker tortured into treason who pleaded, comrades, slay for me the coppers, took my soul. Close my eyes, good comrades, for I played a traitor's role. The meeting started and came down to business. The chairman was Joe Weber, who represented the Steelworkers Organizing Committee. Outlining the purpose of the mass meeting, he flung an arm at the Republic plant, a third of a mile down the road. 25,000 men were on strike. Their purpose was to picket peacefully, to win a decent raise in wages so that they might exist like human beings. But there had been a constant, brutal provocation by the police. Well, they were gathered here, as was their constitutional right, to protest that interference. Dozens of strikers had been arrested, beaten, waylaid. Strikers' property, as, for example, a sound truck, had been smashed and destroyed. Even women had been beaten, dragged off to jail, treated obscenely. The National Labor Relations Act guaranteed them their rights. Today they're going to demonstrate in support of those rights. I just want to stop here for a second and just compare this to what you've been seeing in videos from the Occupies about the beatings, the destruction of property. As a matter of fact, this week, I believe there's a lawsuit started over the destruction of the Occupy Wall Street Library at Liberty
Square. Oh, did they
Square.
File that lawsuit?
Yeah. Also known as Zuccotti Park.
Right.
Well, back to Howard Fast. Other speakers backed up Weber. When the audience cheered some point, the children present gurgled with delight and clapped their hands. As soon as the meeting had finished, the strikers and their wives and children began to form their picket line. After all, this was Memorial Day. The thing took on a parade air. Some of the strikers had made their own placards. Also, a whole force of them appeared from inside the union hall, made by committees. The slogans were simple, direct, and nonviolent. Republic Steel violates Labor Disputes Act. Win with the CIO. No fascism in America. Republic Steel shall sign a union contract. The signs were handed out, many of them to boys and girls who carried them proudly. At the head of the column that was forming, two men took their place with American flags. The news reporters who had come up by car only a short while before were hopping about now, snapping everything. For some reason that had never been analyzed, news photographers and strikers get along very well, even when the photographers come down from McCormick's Chicago Tribune. There was a lot of good-natured give and take. When the column began to march, down the road from Sam's place first, and then across the prairie toward the Republic Steel plant, the news photographers moved with it, some walking, some by car. This fact later turned into a vital part of American labor history. Republic Steel stood abrupt out of the flat prairie. Snake-like, the line of pickets crossed the meadowland, singing at first, "Solidarity forever! The union makes us strong!" But the song died as the sun-drenched plain turned ominous, as 500 blue-coated policemen took up stations between the strikers and the plant. The strikers' march slowed, but they came on. The police ranks closed and tightened. It brought to mind how other Americans had faced the uniformed force of so-called law and order so long ago on Lexington Green in 1775. But whereas the redcoat leader had said, "Disperse, you rebel bastards," to the armed minutemen, now it was to the unarmed men and women and children that a police captain said, "You dirty sons of bitches, this is as far as you go." About 250 yards from the plant, the police closed in on the strikers. Billies and clubs were out already, prodding, striking, nightsticks edging into women's breasts and groins. It was great fun for the cops, who were somewhat afraid, and they began to jerk guns out of holsters. There's another comparison, too. I think one of the things we have seen is the specific targeting and abuse of women by police in recent months in this country.
Yes.
Stand fast, the line leaders cried. "We've got our right. We've got our legal rights to picket." The cops said, "You got no rights. You red bastards, you got no rights." Even if a modern man's a steel worker, with muscles as close to iron bands as human flesh gets, a pistol equalizes him with a weakling, and more than equalizes. Grenades began to sail now. Tear gas settled like an ugly cloud. Children suddenly cried with panic, and the whole picket line gave back. Men stumbling, cursing, gasping for breath. Here and there, a cop tore out his pistol and began to fire. It was pop, pop, pop at first, like toy favors at some horrible party. And then, as the strikers broke under the gunfire and began to run, the contagion of killing ran like fire through the police. They began to shoot in volleys. It was wonderful sport because these pickets were unarmed men and women. They could not strike back or fight back. The cops squealed with excitement. They ran after fleeing men and women, pressed revolvers to their backs, shot them down, then continued to shoot as the victims lay on their faces, retching blood. When a woman tripped and fell, four cops gathered above her, smashing in her flesh and bones and face. Oh, it was great sport. Wonderful sport for gentle, pot-bellied police, who mostly had to confine their pleasures to beating up prostitutes and street peddlers, at a time when Chicago was world infamous as the center of gangsterism, assorted crime, and murder. And so it went on and on until 10 were dead or dying and over 100 wounded, and the field a bloodstained field of battle. World War veterans there said that never in France had they seen anything as brutal as this. What do we got? Oh, we're running. Well, he goes on and describes how profitable
Republic Steel was.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I want to give you a little bit of background to this situation. What had happened was that the CIO had created the Steel Workers Organizing Committee, or SWOC, and they had done pretty well with big steel, but they were facing a lot of problems from what was called little steel. Mm-hmm. And these were the smaller companies that made actually smaller things. They mm-hmm. made things more like furniture. They didn't make big girders and so on and so forth, and plates for warships, as I'd seen described. And this was a really big problem. And it was related to something that's very interesting and it inspired a play called The Cradle Will Rock.
Hmm.
And, which went ahead and inspired a movie by Tim Robbins called The Cradle Will Rock,
mm-hmm.
which was a pretty good movie. It came out in 1990. And it was there was killing, a lot of repression, steel companies making money hand over fist, you know, the wrong people being put in jail, just as we still see constantly.
Right. Today's corporate world is much the same. It's quite fascinating. As I mentioned, I went to Mount Olive Cemetery there and looked up Mother Jones a little bit. And, you know, you read about the Battle of Verdun. And as you guys, you and Dave have mentioned on this program many times, the Ludlow Massacre out there.
Oh, yes.
You know, mm-hmm. those snipers would just sit there and shoot through the tents, knowing full well that women and children were sitting in those tents and that, you know, they didn't seem to care one iota about those people out there. It's just same thing, corporate greed. I mean, they mentioned that back in the 30s, back in the 1910s and stuff. I came across a website, you know, part of Wikipedia. They got a list of strikes, just absolutely amazing. You know, I mean, they got them listed during the 1800s, 1700s, and then by decade throughout the 1900s and stuff, and every, you know, it's just quite incredible to read through the number of similarities, that stuff that's been going on for 50, 60, 100 years or more, and nothing's really changed.
Yeah, right here is, oh, click, here we go. Yeah, okay, here's where some items ordered by Bethlehem Steel in 1933. From a company called Federal Laboratories. And I found a really interesting website about Federal Laboratories, too, where it explained what some of these things were. 12 blast-type billies. Okay, what a billy was, we all know what a billy club is. And I had never heard of these things. But these a blast-type billy is a billy club that blasts tear gas.
Wow.
Yeah, I guess they were real popular up maybe even to the 70s or something.
Huh.
But okay, 12 of those, 100 blast-type billies cartridges, 24 jump